The Passing Parade. Your favorite stories as told by your favorite storyteller. A man whose voice is familiar to millions of theatergoers and radio listeners. Here's John Nesbitt to bring you some stories from The Passing Parade.
On the reviewing stand, nearly all the unforgettable errors of human judgment which have written airplane disaster into the headlines are unsolved mysteries. The men who make the mistakes or are suddenly overwhelmed by the mistakes of others are killed and there are no living witnesses. Not on this side of heaven will we ever learn what took place in some young man's brain the split second before he crashed. An outstanding example of the baffling character of most of these catastrophes is the case of the airplane which did something that the nation had half expected for 20 years and yet didn't quite believe could happen. The 10-ton Army bombing plane which met its death in a fraction of a moment when it struck the tallest office building in the world. You can't build up any special kind of story. The cold, breathtaking record is all that we ever have. Just before 10 in the morning on Saturday, July 28, 1945, a girl named Nanette Morrison is working away at her typewriter by the window on the 38th floor of a Fifth Avenue skyscraper. Nanette Morrison looks up from her typewriter to see a huge Army airplane roaring past her window. This was a time in the war, you'll remember, when Army and Navy pilots used to get themselves in hot water occasionally by flying close to their girls' houses and buzzing them in daredevil plunges of the planes. For this reason, as the big airplane shoots past her window, Nanette Morrison laughs and waves her hand to the men in the cockpit, and at the same instant, she senses that it is death she is signaling. The young men are sitting like frozen statues in the cockpit, hypnotized by their peril, their arms tearing at the controls, to try to get their plane to climb. Nanette stands there in the skyscraper window, frozen too now, her fist jammed against her lips. Hundreds and perhaps thousands of New Yorkers, like Nanette, glanced up at that instant to gaze upon the birth of a disaster. And since it was unbelievable, few of them could realize what their eyes were announcing to them. Another New York girl named Maria Little writes in her report to me, "I was window shopping down below on Fifth Avenue looking at the coats in Lord & Taylor's. The roar of the propellers frightened me. I looked up to see the plane shooting straight down the avenue between the tall buildings, and I thought it was a stunt. I said to a friend, 'If that dizzy flyer isn't careful, he'll go right on until he runs into the Empire State Building.' We both laughed, and we turned back to look at a mink coat, and my friend said, 'Yes, that's what Mayor LaGuardia is always complaining about,' and then we both gasped, for a roar like a munitions factory exploding shook the entire center of town. Perhaps 50,000 people confessed willingly later that their first thought had been, 'America is being attacked from the air by some new rocket bomb.' At this moment, a cloudburst of concrete, of metal, and jagged pieces of glass was showering down on Fifth Avenue and 34th Street, from where rises the tallest man-made pinnacle upon the globe, the Empire State. 90 feet away from the point between the 78th and the 79th floors, where this bomb of metal and living men had struck, there was a sculptor's studio. Through seven thick walls tore an immense motor from the demolished airplane, and that motor plummeted into the artist's studio and demolished it. The second motor was found later deep in the basement of the skyscraper, 925 feet from the point of that indescribable impact between a bombing plane and a tower. And there was no mystery about this, for the second motor had passed through walls of brick and empty offices, had penetrated an elevator shaft, and then dropped like a stone to the basement. In the higher offices, that is, in the higher windows of office buildings nearby the Empire State, men had been sitting at their desks, feet up on the blotters, telephoning their wives about getting home early that Saturday. Others were salesmen, getting in a few last orders before closing shop. Others, hundreds of others, were office girls telephoning companions and planning shopping expeditions in the early afternoon. There was a cool mist that morning, and Midtown Manhattan, which is no place for man or beast during a July heat wave, was on this day a very pleasant place to hunt for scarce merchandise or take in a matinee. So when, through the fog, the ghost-like shape hurtled past and the bellow of sound shook the metropolis, all of those telephoners in the windows simply stopped speaking in the middle of the breath at once. At the other end of 100 lines, the wives and the boyfriends and the customers began jiggling the receiver stand, signaling the operator that they were cut off. Or they kept saying into the mouthpiece, "What is it? Why have you stopped talking?" A long, long wait. And then the reply, In God's name, I don't know. But I guess we're invaded. We'll sum up the records of this mystery, which holds no solution, just as soon as our announcer takes the usual intermission here, and then the evidence that remains concerning the unbelievable traffic accident of the Passing Parade.
That's the first half of John Nesbitt's story on today's Passing Parade. While he's preparing his notes for the second portion, let's listen to some music from Victor Young. Here again is John Nesbitt to continue his story on The Passing Parade.
On the reviewing stand once more, in the many minutes of dazed horror and confusion that began with the dying out of the explosion when the airplane cut its way into the Empire State Building, it might be expected that panic would make its appearance and attend to its usual business of piling horror upon horror and extending the death list. But here, for once, panic, the great destroyer in disaster, did not tear loose and bring madness into the story. The day and the hour saved hundreds of lives. For it was Saturday morning, and the five-day week had become the usual way in the United States. So instead of there being 15,000 living people in the Empire State Building at the moment of the crash, there was only a tenth that number, 1,500. Beside the pilot and his crew, 10 people died in their offices, while 26 others were wounded but survived. Many of these owe their lives to another accident. This accident being that at the moment of the disaster, walking along the sidewalk past the skyscraper, there was a 17-year-old boy with brains and a steady heart. His name was Donald Maloney. He was very proud of serving his country, even though he was too young for active duty and was a hospital apprentice in the Coast Guard. As this boy jumped back from the sinister rain of shredded glass and metal that whistled down through the air to Fifth Avenue, he remembered at once that he was being trained to administer to bodies shattered by war. Young Donald kept his head, as thousands of others gazed upward, gasping about an invasion or some new weapon of the enemy. He dashed into a drugstore. Minutes before the ambulance sirens could be heard wailing down the streets, this Donald was shouting to a drug clerk to give him morphine, hypodermic needles, and other restricted drugs. And the clerk had sense enough to recognize that the law mustn't hold in such a moment, and he gave the boy these supplies. Donald was in the Empire State Building, had fought his way to the elevators, and been taken to the chaos of the floors which had been penetrated by the shattered plane, and within a few moments was treating the screaming victims. And then he squeezed through a knife-edged crevice in the tangled wreckage of machinery. He administered morphine to a woman caught in the mass of twisted metal, and he brought her out of it alive. The 5-day working week saved hundreds, and the boy from the Coast Guard saved his dozen. And then there is the record of a second steady heart in that hour. One of the most likely places where panic might have flared out but failed to appear was on the famous observation gallery in the topmost pinnacle of that immense building. 35 tourists that morning had paid their fee, and at the instant the great projectile dug into the skyscraper, these persons were lined up behind the plate glass on the gallery of floor 86. A flash of flame enveloped the whole tower, and caught as they were up there at the top of the highest building on the earth, a state of frenzy might have arrived. But as the overwhelmed visitors looked at their uniformed guide, this man quietly pulled himself together, and in his most professional tone, he requested them to accompany him at once. The day's tourists obeyed him. He gathered them together and herded them politely to the 65th floor where they took the elevator to the street. The guide's name is Louis Petley. When his routine life brought him this incredible moment of importance, he met his requirement with valor. For the rest of it, the experts came, the generals and the engineers came, and as they knew in advance, the puzzle was totally baffling. The pilot was competent and able, Lieutenant Colonel William Smith, Jr. With him were Staff Sergeant Christopher Dmitrovich and an enlisted man named Albert Perna. This doomed man had been feeling very lucky that morning. He was stuck in Bedford, Massachusetts, and at the last moment had been given the chance to hitchhike aboard this plane to glamorous New York. The bombing plane itself had as its name Old John Feather Merchant. It was in superb and in tested condition. The careful detective work piled up the clues minutely, but they were, of course, useless. It was determined that the big airplane had boomed through the canyon made by the buildings on Fifth Avenue at a speed of 19,800 feet each minute. That speed was not enough, as I understand it, for the craft to rise in time above the soaring tower that lay ahead. Mayor LaGuardia arrived at the place of the tragedy within minutes of the echoing thunder, and he said the obvious thing. He was flying too low. And although this opinion might sound preposterously unnecessary, it contains the only fact which is certain. For the cause of the 18-foot hole in the skin of the Empire State Building, for the deaths of the 10 and for the instant oblivion that took the men aboard the plane, the cause lies in some microscopic connection in the brain of the pilot. This invisible failure of human thinking hides the mystery of the disaster. It was this that led the pilot to fly appallingly low over Manhattan Island on a morning of blinding fog. It was this that led him to ignore a radioed warning that came to the plane from LaGuardia Field. And ironically, the weather tower actually used a phrase that prophesied the incomprehensible accident. For the warning was, the visibility is so bad we can't even see the top of the Empire State Building. So whether there was a dreadful cross-circuit in the brain of an intelligent man or a hidden failure within the intricate workings of the airplane, the story, like the others, must go down the years without a conclusion. The men who make the airplanes and the men who fly them, they simply stopped long enough to draw in their breaths as they read the news. It's part of the down payment we must make to capture the sky, they said, and they went on with their work. Whether they spoke it aloud or not, all of these men knew that this was exactly what would have been wanted by the men who desperately fought that airplane amok as it whistled like an arrow straight down Fifth Avenue to oblivion.
You have been listening to Your Favorite Stories as Told by America's Favorite Storyteller, John Nesbitt. Be with us the next time we move to the reviewing stand for yet another glimpse of The Passing Parade. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.